Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Gemfields Group Interim Results Call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions later during the conference. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero. Please note that this call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Sean Gilbertson, the CEO. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much indeed, Irene. Good morning to you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm joined here in our office in London by David Lovett, our Group CFO, and also by Tyrone Rahman, who is our Group Financial Controller. We have a fairly extensive deck of slides this morning, so we won't cover each and every one of them. I would like to draw your attention to the important notice and disclaimer on slide number two, which I do encourage you to read if you've not already done so. If I could ask you please to turn to page three, we're going to look briefly at changes to our group structure diagram. In short, you will see, if you joined our last call, that our stake in Jupiter Mines Limited, shown on the bottom right-hand side of the page, has now reduced by 50% to 3.72%, denoting conclusion of the sale of the first tranche of 50% shares in Jupiter, with the second tranche of 50% due to conclude in November of this year. You will also notice that there is no more 50% holding in Kariba Minerals Limited, the erstwhile 50-50 joint venture that we had with ZCCM-IH in Zambia. You will also note that at the top of that slide, a couple of changes to our shareholder structure have occurred in that Fidelity International are now the second largest shareholder after Dr. Christo Visa. The shareholding that you see fifth along that set of shareholders is a circular shareholding whereby the company owns shares in itself. We remain in the process of getting rid of that shareholding, which obviously will then have the effect of increasing the overall percentage owned by each one of the other shareholders. I should also point out that that process is independent of the share buyback process that the company has been running, and we'll provide you with an update on the share buyback a little bit later on in this pack. I should also point out that you can still see Sedibelo Platinum Mines on the bottom left-hand side. There's been no change in our valuation of Sedibelo Platinum Mines on our balance sheet at the 30th of June 2019. And as we've said before, that is an asset that we would like to realize should an appropriate opportunity arise. If I could ask you now to change to slide number five, we have depicted here the share price performance of Gemfields Group Limited, formerly Pallinghurst Resources Limited, both over the course of 1 year, and you can see that the share price has slid in South African rand terms from 2.10 rand to approximately 1.60 rand, and over the course of 5 years has declined from some 4.90 rand down to the same 1.60 rand. Obviously a very poor share price performance indeed, and one of the reasons underpinning the buyback that has been running for a few months. Over the page on slide number six, we don't need to spend any time on this, but this depicts very similar looking graphs, but we've plotted that for the sake of easy reference in US dollar terms. What is more interesting is page number seven, in which we have plotted the respective market capitalizations of Gemfields Limited, which was formerly called Gemfields PLC, and also Gemfields Group Limited, which was formerly Pallinghurst Resources Limited. And it is very interesting to note that at the point that Gemfields Group Limited acquired what was then Gemfields PLC, the market capitalization of the combined group, shown here in a sort of orangey brown, did try and pick up to reflect the combination of the two sets of assets. At that point in time, Gemfields PLC was relatively heavily indebted. But as you can see, subsequently, the share price has decayed to a point now where Gemfields Group Limited today has a market valuation significantly below the already depressed price at which Gemfields PLC delisted from the AIM market, notwithstanding the fact that its financial performance has improved considerably, and of course the balance sheet is in much better shape. Again, one of the underpinning reasons for the present share buyback. If you turn to slide number 8, we have presented here some market comparables, Gemfields versus some of the major mining companies and also some of the available gemstone peers. I would draw your attention to the free cash flow yield in column number 3, where Gemfields is delivering approximately 13.8%. That is, at present, the highest of the assorted figures in that column, except, of course, for Petra Diamonds, which is delivering a whopping 52%, driven primarily, of course, by its markedly low share price. Our PE ratio is more or less in line with many of the peers, but do bear in mind that our earnings at the moment are heavily knocked by the 15% export duty which we face in Zambia. Similarly, when it comes to EV to EBITDA and EV sales, certainly Gemfields looks like a good value purchase, another reason underpinning the present share buyback. On slide number 9, most of our investors are familiar with our ownership of 75% of Kaja Mining Limited, the world's largest emerald mine, and the third asset shown here in red, which is 75% of the Montepuez Ruby Mine. Those are the two major pistons within the group. In Zambia, we have just received consents to transfer 3 of our 13 wholly owned emerald licenses into Kaja Mining Limited, whereby we are therefore creating, together with government, a much more significant vehicle to pursue the emerald sector. One of the licenses that has been approved for transfer is called Mbuva Chibelele, which we started opening up at the back end of 2017, and which has to date produced a little bit north of 10 million carats. And so when that transaction is implemented, we hope within the next 2 to 3 weeks, we will be able to reap the economies of scale of running 2 adjacent operations separated by the Kafubu River, and of course sharing all the planning, equipment, washing plant, and the like. During the period under consideration, the 6 months to the 30th of June 2019, Kajum brought in revenues of $33.2 million, and Montepuez brought in revenues of $50 million. Shareholders who've been following Gemfields will also be aware that earlier this year we entered into an arrangement with our partners in the Montepuez Ruby mining operation, whereby we are going to have a look at gold licenses located in the same area as the Montepuez Ruby mining district, pretty close by. And at the moment we have moved the project manager that was running our operations up in Ethiopia, which were overrun a couple of years ago, down to Mozambique, and that team is now in the process of getting their aerial survey quotations, getting their camps established, and the baseline studies are presently underway so that we can carry out the appropriate exploration activities in relation to what is called Nairoto Gold or Nairoto Minerals in Mozambique. If I could ask you to turn to slide number 10, please. We're not going to walk through the entire slide here, but this sets out some of the somewhat convoluted history of this particular company, formerly known as Palinghurst Resources Limited, today known as Gemfields Group Limited, and the assorted board changes that have occurred. But I would like to draw your attention to the last 3 items on that timeline, which was that in April of 2019, the company took the decision to realize its investment in Jupiter. 50% of that has been completed. The other 50% will complete in November of this year. And then in June 2019, we announced our intention to distribute a little bit shy of $25 million by way of both a share buyback, and to the extent that there are remaining funds after the share buyback to pay that out as a special dividend, and that commitment remains on track. And we have also stated our intention to seek a listing on AIM, which we are currently working on and hope will be in place by the back end of 2019. At that juncture, I'm going to hand you over to David Lovett, our CFO.
Thank you, Sean, and good morning, everyone. So on slide 11, we have some headline figures from the interim accounts to the 30th of June. I'll just run you through some of these, and then I'll hand over to Tyrone, who will go through some more of the details. So as Sean said on the previous rundown of the operations, the revenues achieved in this period primarily come from three auctions, two at Kagem producing $33 million and one at MRM producing $50 million. That is down against the 2018 comparative, primarily due to the fall in the auction revenue from MRM. So we were looking at a $72 million auction in the previous period for multi-purpose ruby mining, and in this period it's dropped to 50. On the flip side, Kagem has actually improved in terms of revenue from 21 in 2018 to 33 in this period. Moving down the P&L, you get to the EBITDA figure, which is 33.1 million. That's actually higher than the 28 figure, despite having lower revenues, and that is driven by the margins achieved by Kagem. So as Kagem's high-quality auction achieved more revenue, the margins on the high-quality auctions are high, and therefore that feeds straight into your EBITDA. Moving down, we have the cash flows from operating activities. This figure includes the cost of sales, and that comes out at $28 million for this period against $18 million for the prior period. And that gives us a free cash flow figure for the period of $7.5 million. Normalized earnings, which excludes any transactions in relation to the Jupiter investment, sit at $4.5 million. And our net cash balance at the 30th of June 2019 is $35.5 million. That doesn't include the $28.4 million of auction receivables that are currently sitting on our balance sheet. I'll now hand over to Tyrone to run through some of the segmental analysis.
Thanks, David. Morning, all. So on slide 12, we've put out the segmental cash flow. I'll just take you through some of the key numbers. David has mentioned the $33 million revenue earned at Kagem, primarily from two auctions, a low quality and a high quality. The May 19 high quality auction was significantly higher than the May 18. In May 18, we only sold 50% of the lots. That drives straight into Kagem showing a significantly higher EBITDA at $13 million. And then from that, Kagem has paid $2 million worth of capex. We note that this capex is artificially low and will be weighted towards the second half of the year. All in all, Kagem has generated free cash flow of $3 million despite the inclusion of the 15% export duty. At MRM, the $50 million auction is a mixed quality held in Singapore. This compares to the $72 million, which was record highs in 2018. The fall in revenues at MRM largely driven by the product mix as prices remain strong. At corporate costs are slightly down on last year, mainly marketing costs, which are weighted towards the second half of the year. And at Fabergé, we've got higher costs than expected, largely, again, due to timing. Capex at MRM, $12 million, largely, again, to expansion and exploration. And $3 million of that $12 million relates to Megaruma, which is one of our bulk sampling projects adjacent to MRM. The takeaway from our fee for the cash flows for the period is that both mines remain cash generative, and this is despite having the 15% overhanging us in Zambia. So all in all, free cash flow for the period, the 6 months, $9.7 million, represents 11% of our revenue for the period. On to the income statement. We've been through the revenue. Fabergé revenues are slightly lower than expected, mainly due to the timing of high-value jewelry sales. We expect that in the second half, this will pick up to levels similar to the prior year. Within the costs, you'll see the mineral and production, mineral royalties and production costs, which are straight percentages of revenue, 6% in Zambia and 10% in Mozambique. You'll also see there for the first time the $5 million export duty that we have to pay on all sales in Zambia. Mining and production costs at the mines are slightly up on last year, mainly driven due by the higher rock handling and inflationary pressures in both countries. Selling administrative costs are down on last year, mainly due to the marketing and labor elements of the corporate office in London. The marketing costs are slightly down, but we expect this to pick up in the second half of the year. Other things to note within the income statement are the fair value movements in Jupiter, which show an unrealized gain of $5 million. We expect to realize this on the sale of the next tranche, which will conclude in November of this year. We've also received a $2.5 million dividend from Jupiter. Operating profit for the year, $23.4 million. On top of that, we've paid $8 million, well, there's an $8 million tax charge. The large tax charge gives an effective tax rate of about 41%. The 41% reflects the tax regime in Zambia, whereby mineral royalties are no longer deductible for tax purposes. Moving to the balance sheet, there's a few things to note. One is, as Sean mentioned in his introduction, Kariba has been, our investment in Kariba was liquidated during the course of the year, of which we received $3.5 million net of property transfer tax. We will note that the finance costs as a whole have reduced over the year following the repayment of the Gordon Brothers loan. Our investment in Citadelo remains at $50 million, consistent with the year end, as we believe there's no change in market conditions that would lead to a change in that valuation. You'll also realize there's a $17 million investment in Jupiter. That represents the fair value of the proceeds to be received in November. Other things quickly on the balance sheet. In total, the net asset value of the group has gone up by $14 million, mainly reflecting the earnings over the period. We have $75 million worth of cash. This excludes the 28.4 auction receivables David mentioned earlier. And we have a gross debt number of 39.8, which consists of $30 million in Zambia. This reduced from $35 million as we made a $5 million principal payment in March, and the remainder of that relates to the revolving credit facilities utilization at MRM. Just a note is that the Cardium facilities of $30 million are in process of being refinanced for another 5 years, which will mean Cardium has got sufficient working capital for the foreseeable future. On that note, I will hand over back to David.
Thanks, Tyrone. So the next three slides I won't spend much time on, but slide 15 shows effectively head office costs. It should be noted that there are costs relating to Gemfields Group Limited, which aren't included here, which are approximately $2 million per annum. That would give you a number of about $23 million of head office costs over a 12-month period. Slide 16 gives you the net cash profile, shows cash balance against debt. And then slide 17 shows you the gross debt figure, which, as Tyrone said, is largely Kajem. So $30 million of debt at Kajem. The rest is a revolving credit facility we have in Mozambique. I'll now hand back to Sean to go through some of the operations.
Thank you very much, David. So, ladies and gentlemen, we'll have a look at the overview of the two mining operations side by side on slide 20 for a moment before looking at Kajem. And then David will take us through Montepuez Ruby Mining. We put this slide 20 together simply to show the big contrast between the mining operations at Kajem and at MRM. In the first line, you can see the production of premium emeralds and premium rubies at the two respective operations in the first 8 months of this year. In other words, these are figures that run to the end of August rather than the end of June. And we typically say to investors that a good rule of thumb
is that if we want to be in a very comfortable position, we would like to see 10,000 premium carats from each of the mining operations every month. Given these are 8-month figures, therefore, we would ideally like to see 80,000 carats at Kagem, and we have indeed produced 106,000, so that's a very comfortable position. Whereas at Montepuez Ruby Mining, we would similarly have liked to have seen 80,000 carats to have been very comfortable, but we have to date only produced 49,000 carats. The other figure that's interesting here in terms of considering the two operations is row number 3, which is the ore processed. You can see that at Kagem, we are putting through the washing plant only 95,000 tons during the first 8 months, whereas at Montepuez Ruby Mining, it's almost 570,000 tons, and that's because we're dealing generally with much lower grades and the processing volumes required at MRM are considerably higher. That grade effect can be seen in the line item labeled the premium grade or grade premium, and you can see that at Kagem during the first 8 months of this year, we have seen 1 premium carat per ton, versus at Montepuez Ruby Mining, it is 0.1 premium carats per ton. You can also see in the second last row that the rock handling capacity at Kagem is approximately twice that of Montepuez Ruby Mining, and the stripping ratios of the two operations could hardly be more different. Kagem has a stripping ratio so far this year of 83-1, which is pretty unusual in almost any mining operation, versus Montepuez Ruby Mining, which has a much more common 5-1 ratio. If we take a closer look then at the most recently completed CPRs on slide 21 of the competent persons reports, what you will see in the fourth row is that the NPVs calculated in these CPRs according to the SAMREC code standard back in December 2017 for Kagem and August 2018 for MRM were $528 million and $527 million respectively. You can see that the life of mine was 27 years at Kagem and 16 years at MRM. Again, this contrasts the difference between the two operations, and it is worth noting that in our pursuit of an AIM listing by the end of this year, these two CPRs are obviously in the process of being updated to reflect the latest circumstances. Moving on to slide number 22, what I personally consider to be perhaps one of the more informative slides in the pack, but you can see here the revenue contribution shown every month, but on a last 12 months basis, for the three key revenue contributors that sit inside of the Gemfields group. Obviously, Fabergé was only acquired by Gemfields PLC in January 2013, and Gemfields PLC, in turn, was acquired by Gemfields Group Limited in August of 2017. But the entire history of those three revenue generators is shown here, and these figures again run to the end of August, and we can see that the business is pretty close, based on auctions and Fabergé sales orders agreed, to remaining at the $200 million mark in the last 12 months. This does obviously exclude some of the small additional sales that we get from our remaining cut and polished inventory and a small number of direct sales, particularly of lower quality emeralds and beryl that we make directly to customers, notably in India. If we move on then to slide 24, we have provided a summary here of all the auctions that we've run to date for Kagem. The green ones are the higher quality auctions, the yellow ones, the commercial quality auctions, and the aggregate of all of those figures comes to $608 million US dollars for Kagem to date. Having a quick look at the number of carats produced by the respective operations, on slide number 25, you can see total carats produced. We like to remind investors that the total number of carats is not a particularly helpful figure, the reason being that the pricing from our least expensive carats to our most expensive carats changes by approximately 1.5 million times. In other words, all the value is in the higher quality gemstones. And for Cardrim, we get approximately 35 to 40% of our revenue just from the premium emerald. And in this slide on page 25, the premium emerald is shown in red, and it's obviously so small that it's quite difficult to see. What is worth noting at Cardrim is that because we do now have an increased number of pits operating, we have not seen the very marked decrease and volatility that we have previously in the last 12-month figures, and that figures have not declined very much below the 35 million carats per annum production that we've seen over the last sort of 12 months. If we zoom in to the premium carats in red, that's what's shown on slide number 26, and you will see a rather ominous-looking decline to the right-hand side of a label in red. But that's an important watershed moment for us because there were material changes made to the grading system, and therefore one should really only consider the right-hand side of that as being fairly consistent. The left-hand side was a different standard. And what we can see is that the premium emerald production, from which 35 to 40% of our revenue comes at Cardrim, did get above 200,000 premium carats per annum and has come down a little bit, but remains comfortably above the 10,000 premium carat per month figure that we like to see. Looking at the premium carats now on slide number 27, in a slightly different format, the line in red, which runs to the end of August, shows us the number of premium carats produced to date at 105,000. We are, at the end of August, already above the budgeted figure for the full year, which is shown in green, and we are obviously also ahead of 2016 and 2017, but some way behind the very happy results that we achieved in 2018, shown in yellow. If we move down one category of quality from the premium emerald to the emerald production is shown on the same basis on slide number 28, and you can see here that we are tracking well insofar as the measurements are concerned against both the budget and also what happened for us in 2016 and 2018. Over the page, slide number 29, we like to look at the history of the assets on a last 12-month basis and also to present the data going all the way back to the beginning of our involvement so that investors can get a full picture of what's happened. In the first graph on this page, we're looking at the total operating costs on a last 12-month basis. And we can see that at the end of August, the LTM, or last 12-month costs, were sitting at approximately $36 million US dollars. The very big bulge that you see in the middle of this graph was a very big pushback exercise in which we moved a great deal of waste to open up the pit. And that is reflected in the graph immediately below that, where we're looking at the 12-month rock handling. Again, it's the last 12 months in every one of the bars that you see there. And you can see that presently Cardrim is operating at approximately 13 million tons per annum, which is clearly roughly a million tons per month. That obviously distills down onto the in the next page on slide number 30 into our unit rock handling costs. And given that the rock handling has been increasing at Cardrim with increases in the dollar operating cost, we would hope to see a decline in the unit rock handling costs, and that is now gradually starting to come through to the point where our rock handling cost in the last 12 months is approximately $2.93. If we then look at slide number 31, we're looking at the unit costs per premium carat in the first graph, and this is obviously very characteristic of color gemstone deposits and the volatility that they display, not only in the actual grade or the carats per ton, but also in the underlying quality of the carats that we do recover. And we can see here that Cardrim had us all shaking in the knees at the back end of 2017 when the cost per premium carat pipped almost $900 a carat. But with the advent of the increase in carats
premium carats, we can obviously see that the present production cost per premium carat has fallen to just north of $200 per carat, which is pretty solid. The graph below that, again, is a little bit less helpful in that it considers overall carats, which is not the figure that we'd recommend people to focus on, given the wide variety of values inherent in those figures. But we can see that Kagem is in a fairly happy position in terms of its overall cost per carat. Slide number 32 depicts the total capex incurred at Kagem in any preceding 12-month period. And we can see that between 2015 and the third quarter of 2018, there was a pretty big gap of very little expenditure at Kagem in order to conserve cash within the wider group. Now that the balance sheet is in a better position and the company is generally performing better, we have had to top up the capex, particularly yellow goods, at Kagem, and that's why we see the very considerable spike in February-March of 2019, and that figure will now calm down. Slide number 33 shows a picture of what the Kagem mining pit looks like. That pit, open cast, obviously, is now 140 meters deep, hence explaining the 85-to-1 stripping ratio. And I will now hand back to David, who's going to walk us through performance at Montepuez Ruby.
Thank you, Sean. So if we start on slide 35, this shows a similar representation of revenue to the one you've seen for Kagem. It shows each auction we've held at Montepuez Ruby Mining with a total number of $513 million and shows the $50 million achieved in June 19. Slide 36 shows the total production, but as Sean said, and actually even more so for rubies, the important part is the tiny piece at the top of those bars, which is the premium production. So slide 37 breaks us out purely the premium production at Montepuez. What we can see here is there is certainly a decline in premium production. That is something the team are working on, and it's also related to the expansion and exploration side of the entire license area. So we do expect to see that pick up slightly. On the positive side, the mine is still profitable and cash generative at these levels. So there is no concern, but it would be nice to see those numbers moving back up. The next two slides break that production out into a line. As you can see, the premium ruby production is lagging behind both the budget and the previous years. And then the total production is closer to where we've been previously. But as I've said, we hope those numbers will increase. Moving on to slide 40, the top chart here shows the last 12 months of operating costs on a cash basis. So this is the rolling 12-month number. What you can see is a spike around the end of 18, which relates to the settlement costs from the law firm Lee Day. We do expect, once that drops out, for the number to be relatively stable at around $30 million at MRM. Moving on to slide 41, what this shows is the 12-month unit rock handling cost in US dollar per ton. So again, you can see the spike at the end of 18, which relates to Lee Day. This has now been pushed back down. As we increase the amount of rock handled, we expect this to go down below the $6 per ton number. And as we increase volumes at MRM, we hope to bring this down significantly more. The chart at the top of slide 42 shows your unit cost per premium carat. This has increased quite significantly, and this is obviously directly related to the fall in production of premium carats. And then slide 43, which shows the capex for the last 12 months. Again, this number is relatively high as we sit right now. It's worth noting that this includes the Sort House, which was upgraded earlier this year, and the Rat Village. So the Rat Village relates to the Resettlement Action Plan, where we've been involved in building 105 houses for the villagers that were based on our license area. So slide 45 gives you some images from that resettlement plan, The 105 houses, I believe, are now all complete and ready for passing on to the locals over the next few months. With that, I'll pass back to Sean to run through the Fabergé operation.
Thank you very much, David. Ladies and gentlemen, we're on slide number 47, and we're looking on the left-hand side in green at the last 12-month figures in terms of sales orders agreed for Fabergé, and you will see that at the end of August, Fabergé's annual sales orders agreed stood at approximately $12 million, therefore pretty flat, despite the fact that the team have, on the right-hand side of this graph, made a very big reduction in the 12-month OPEX figures, which peaked a little north of $18 million and presently sit below $10 million. So I think our management team have done a good job in maintaining sales levels at approximately $12 million. It's also interesting to note that the IFRS performance figures for the first 6 months of this year are pretty dismal, but that is because IFRS obviously only allows us to book the sales once the items have been delivered, irrespective of whether or not we've actually been paid. By contrast, what we're looking at here in green is the number of sales orders agreed, whereby delivery and or payments may only take place at a later stage. However, based on 10 years of data at Fabergé, our sales orders agreed are pretty robust, and the number of sales orders agreed which do not for some reason go to delivery and or payment is negligible. On slide number 48, we're looking here at the number of pieces sold in the preceding 12 months on the left-hand side. The green bit is the sales that we've made directly to end consumers, whereas the yellow is our wholesale sales, which have been made to, for example, multi-brand retailers. We can see a considerable jump. That, however, should be considered as an exceptional item and is driven largely by a transaction whereby we sold a little bit north of 200 items of old inventory, predominantly watches, which go back to 2009, 2010, and that's why we see the spike in the number of pieces sold. And that's also reflected in the graph on the right-hand side, where we've seen a considerable jump in the number of transactions. This arises primarily from a sample sale which we ran here in London in order to try and shift out some of the older inventory, and obviously that's resulted in a large number of sales transactions over the course of 2 days only, and that's what's created the spike. But generally the trend, both in terms of the number of pieces sold and also the number of sales transactions, is moving in the right direction. On slide number 49, the most important metric for the Fabergé management team is their cash draw on the group, and that we have set a target for the management team to keep that figure below $5 million. You will see that at December 2018, they managed to get down from a peak of some $24 million per annum to $4.25 million per annum. That has crept up a little by the end of June, but is on its way back down, and the team expects to finish sub $5 million by year-end, December 2019. David, I'll then hand back to you for the board remuneration.
Okay, so slide 51, what we've tried to show here is a comparison of the Gemfields Group Limited, which is obviously the Pallinghurst Resources Limited, previous name, and Gemfields Limited, which is former Gemfields PLC, against where we are today. So while the 2019 figure is a six-month figure, it's worth noting that the number of execs included in there is more than it was previously. So under the previous Gemfields PLC management team, there was two execs. There are now, including the Gemfields Limited board, five execs included in those figures. Moving on to slide 52, this is showing where we are in terms of the share buyback. So as at the end of September the 18th, we had purchased 11.1 million shares back from the market at a weighted average price of R1.50. That process will continue And now that we are out of the closed period, we have slightly more control over what will happen there. And then finally, on slide 53, there isn't much new here in terms of our pursuing a London listing, other than the fact that we feel that AIM is the right place for Gemfields to come back to, and that we have appointed FinCap as our nominated advisor. The target is still Q4 2019, but as things are firmed up and we have a solid timetable, we will obviously update investors.
Thank you very much, David. At this point, we'll hand back to Irene, our operator, who will facilitate any questions you might have.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if anyone would like to ask a question, you're welcome to press star and then one on your touchtone phone. If you, however, wish to withdraw your question, you may press star and then two to remove yourself from the question queue. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. Our first question is from Des Meyers of AfriFocus Securities.
Good morning, folks. Just going through the numbers, and I commend you for very good performance from the Fabergé performance, the good performance from both the colored gemstone operations. The one concern I have is Seti Belo. What progress are we likely to make on the Seti Belo front? You know, we've seen a huge improvement in platinum group metals. All the various prices of platinum has started to pick up. We've had a big increase in the price of palladium and rhodium. Are we likely to see benefits coming through to Seti Belo on this front? Or just like your comments on that one, please.
Thank you very much, Des. Obviously a good question. As you know, that is an asset that we would like to realize should a suitable opportunity arise. I don't think that we are necessarily going to see immediate benefits directly as a group from the generally increasing sentiment and prices surrounding platinum group metals. Obviously, a lot of the other companies have seen their share prices increase pretty dramatically. The only thing I would say is that perhaps it increases the chances of some form of corporate transaction surrounding Seti Belo, in which this company might then be able to participate. I wish that I was able to give you more concrete prognosis as to how things are going to pan out. Unfortunately, it is a bit of a wait-and-see situation.
I see. Okay. Do we have problems, for more your knowledge of the reef, do we have major problems in terms of faulting? Is that a big issue in the difficult mining operations underway?
There's so obviously this company holds 6.5% in Seti Belo. It is a private company. They do make some information available. The reporting detail that we get at our level is not ideal, but it is certainly fair to say, based on what I have seen and my understanding, that it is not a straightforward and easy ore body, and that it is a fairly complex task for that team to mine.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Our next question is from Giuseppe Murray, of a private investor.
Good morning, team. I would like to just ask for update on Kel Technology.
Giuseppe, thank you very much indeed for your question. I fear I am not in a position to be able to give you a thorough update on the Kel progress at Seti Belo, or indeed where the team presently stands with it. However, what I can obviously undertake to do is, if you'd like to reach out to us, either via the website or just give our direct telephone number a buzz, I will get that information from the team to the extent that they're able to disclose it to us from Seti Belo, and happy to give you the update to the extent that we get information from them.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if anyone else would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. We have a follow-up question from Des Meyers.
A further question I have. It would appear to me that, looking at the broad international demand for gemstones, that the diamond business is certainly experiencing a pretty difficult period, while I would think that the demand for rubies and emeralds certainly starting to improve quite markedly. Is that your thinking as well, that we're basically looking at the modern colored stones as a more desirable gem than the old-fashioned diamonds? What do your thoughts be on this one, please?
Thank you very much, Des. Obviously, quite a lot of points that can be made in that context. I would certainly agree with you that the diamond sector is not presently in a happy place. Many of the share prices obviously severely depressed. Big problems in the middle market. Access to liquidity is difficult. Margins seem to be a little bit lower. Fortunately, those issues are not affecting our industry. The ruby market, as far as we can tell, notwithstanding the Hong Kong show, which has just taken place this week and was obviously very muted given the difficulties recently in Hong Kong, the ruby market remains robust as far as we can tell, and our expectations are pretty solid for our auction in Singapore in December. So it's pretty much happy news on rubies. There are some signs that the darker tone stones are not enjoying quite as much demand, but there's also a lot of evidence that anybody looking for a greater than 8 carat premium fine ruby, no heat, is going to struggle with doing that. So we expect to see strong demand for bigger fine gems. The emerald market, similarly, you will have seen from our previous comments that after the last auction, we indicated that we have seen green shoots of spring, green shoots of recovery. Certainly the figures at our last auction were much better. We were delighted to welcome a Chinese customer, the first one to be successful at that auction. And I think that's a very good development for the emerald sector. Our team have also just completed a trip to China in seeking out further Chinese customers. I would simply say that we clearly hope that those green shoots will continue to flourish. But as is often the way with recovering sectors, we may yet see things take a little bit of a wobble. But at the moment, our sector, our industry, precious colored gemstones, seems to be in a pretty good place and is not being affected by the same problems that the diamond sector is seeing. Insofar as your question is concerned as to whether that's because colored gemstones are hip and cool, and I think the phrase used for diamonds was old-fashioned, I prefer to think of them all as wonderful gemstones, and diamonds have obviously been with us for a long time, and I'm sure they will be with us for a long time, and personally, I'm not that concerned about the arising or perceived threat of synthetic diamonds by virtue of the fact that laboratory-grown or synthetic rubies and emeralds have been around for a very long time, and they sell for a fraction of the price of the natural product, and I think ultimately the diamond sector will probably go in the same direction. I think what is different is that ours is a newer sector, and it's a growing sector which is not yet efficient, and therefore what makes it exciting is that if we're able to bring consistent, reliable supply to the market, we're going to see a pipeline of people get increasingly involved in the sector because the margins are also higher, which is not the case in the diamond sector. So if that framework perception is correct, the next few years should be very interesting for our industry. Thank you for the question.
Super. Good to hear.
Just a final reminder, if anyone else would like to ask a question, you're welcome to press star and then one. We will pause a moment to see if we have any further questions. We have a follow-up from Giuseppe Murray. Giuseppe, your line is live.
Sorry. I would like to know, when can we expect a dividend announcement?
Giuseppe, thank you for the question. So as we have indicated, there is just shy of $25 million, which will go to shareholders in one form or the other. Our first priority, especially whilst the share price is this low, is to allocate that funding towards the share buyback. And so I'm afraid it's a little bit tricky to give you specific timing. We want to see how many shares we can purchase back using that $25 million pool of funds, bearing in mind that we are presently capped at buying back 10% of the shares in issue, approximately 140 million shares, of which now 11 million have already been bought back. And so we don't know exactly how long that process will take, or indeed whether or not we'll be able to get the full 140 million shares. But as soon as that has happened, it is our intention to pay out the remaining funds out of that $25 million as a special dividend. So that's where we presently stand, Giuseppe.
And what's the price that you are willing to pay for the buyback? So you said that the average price was around 50, but up until what price are you still going to continue buying back shares?
So Giuseppe, perhaps somewhat unusually, we have not put a fixed figure out into the market for the buyback, which is one of the reasons why we felt it was important to use today's opportunity to give the market an update as to how many shares had been purchased and also at what price. Obviously, there's also a little bit of a difficulty in understanding how many shares might be available. There are some shareholders who might be willing to take a lower price, some who'd be willing to take a higher price, and so I'm afraid, again, I'm giving you a little bit of a how long is a piece of string answer. But our task, obviously, here is to try and purchase as many of those 140 million shares at as low a price as possible. And so we're just going to have to wait and see how the market reacts and what we're able to pick up. The only additional bit of information I can give you at this stage is obviously we have been in a closed period up until today's announcement, and therefore the buyback has been happening in isolation by the designated broker. And we obviously now, over the months ahead, have the ability to engage with them a little bit more directly to assess what sort of supply levels of shares might be available.
Thank you.
But since we have no further questions on the lines, would you like to make any closing comments?
None from me, other than, of course, to thank you all for your ongoing patience and support, and indeed to extend our gratitude to the very hard-working Gemfields team across the various jurisdictions. And I would ask you all to keep your fingers crossed during the course of the next 17 days as we await the next budget statements from Zambia, because we certainly would be very pleased to see the 15% export duty go away. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.